We are now recording.
Thank you. Okay, this is David Swartz, the chairman of the Home Inspector Rules and Standards Committee, and we're going to call this meeting to order at 9:34 a.m. Could we get a roll call, please?
Andrew Everoad?
Here.
Peter Leeds?
Here.
Eugene Montgomery?
Here.
David Swartz?
Here.
Paul Steron?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. And then I'm not sure, but if we could get an identification, if there's public members on this call.
Keith Smith.
Okay. Anybody else?
Ron Fillet is on the phone. He is currently muted. I do not have the ability to unmute him. He has to unmute himself, which is star six. Ron, star six, if you wish to unmute yourself. If not, you can just listen to the meeting. But if you have difficulties, I would suggest hanging up and calling back into the meeting if you wish to talk.
That sounds good. Okay, so this committee is not able to take matters that are not within the agenda and address them, discuss, or deal with them at all. But if there are items on the agenda, you're welcome to be a participant in that discussion. Keith, do you have anything specific that you're here for or that you want to have considered for a future agenda item?
Well, hey, first off, I looked at your draft for your minutes that you're going to approve, and I was just looking at item C and D and wondering if those are going to be talked at this meeting here, the pool and spa checklist and the minimum standard.
Yes, those are on the agenda.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, and then I'll just wait and pipe in if I have a question on the other items, I guess.
Sounds good. Okay, very good. Thank you. Can we move on to the adoption of the minutes? It was a pretty brief meeting at the last, in January it was, right? Is there any amendments or changes that are needed for that anybody spotted?
Sir, Mr. Chairman, I make a motion we accept the minutes as written.
And a second.
Second, great. Okay, any discussion on that? Any further? Hearing none. Can we get a roll call vote on the approval of the January 15th, 2020 meeting minutes?
Andrew Everoad?
Aye.
Peter Leeds?
Aye.
Eugene Montgomery?
Abstain.
David Swartz?
Aye.
Paul Steron?
Aye.
Motion carried.
Very good. Thank you so much. All right. Now as we get into the meat of the agenda, review, discussion, and possible action on the following, I'm going to take these out of order and allow for some time for Melissa to arrive and or be present on this call. So I didn't know if where it came from or what it regards exactly, but there is an agenda item J, and it's discussion and possible action on whether to amend the current GFCI standard. Is anybody here to speak on that?
Mr. Chairman, this is Peter. I don't know where that came from, but I think it's a great idea. The GFI standards, the GFI rules in building have changed dramatically since we wrote these standards. And we're showing GFIs in so many different places, specifically garages, overhead doors, clothes washers. It's just unbelievable. So I think it's a good idea that we discuss this at least, what we expect from our home inspectors and how up to date with the current rules we're going to hold them to.
Chairman, this is Kurt Winter, staff member. I was just curious, is the GSI standard within the home inspector standards?
Yes.
Yeah.
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 Did you want that all kind of discussed within I and J and K are all kind of about how you guys are going to go about fixing the standards? Did you want to have that all kind of happen at the same time, or, you know, separate the GFCI as its own topic right now?
Let me address that. As I interpret the standards, and I think we've talked about it within the committee before, it appears that the home inspector in the current standards is required to test the actual device, GFCI device that exists. And then that would be about it. That's about as far as it goes in with regard to clarity on that matter. This was, and I believe this might have come from a person that was applying for your position, Peter, on the committee, and I remember it being mentioned as a kind of a hot button item, and my intent when we get to agenda item I when we get to I is to kind of lay out how we're going to approach a revision to the standards. And in my opinion, what we should do is early on take comments on hot button items that people have, because there's a lot of those out there. There's no mention of smoke detectors in the standards, and then the GFCI thing and some of the others. So this will be wrapped into agenda item I, if that would be okay. Does that make sense?
Sure. Works for me, David.
Okay. Okay, then. Then we'll consider this matter discussed and closed, and we'll address it in item J or I. Gosh, I'm getting confused. Okay, so the next one I'd like to take is, and it might be Paul and Rob, but agenda item is update on National Home Inspector Exam, the NHIE, and exam availability. So if you could address that.
Paul, do you want to go?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, I'll go ahead and start with that. I had been in touch early on with the exam board, EBPHI, that administers the NHIE early on during this COVID crisis, and, you know, got information on when they had reopened their PSI exam centers, which for the most part started back in May. To some centers, and then I had heard that there had been some long waits to take the exam. So I, frankly, trying to get through to PSI is very challenging. Sure. They're a little bit overrun right now with requests from people all across the country. But what I did find out by pulling a few strings, and it's always good to know the executive director. I did find out the status of three of our local centers, and it looked like there was at least one in Phoenix and one in Tucson that had somewhere between a week and 10-day wait period once you registered for the exam before you could sit for the exam, which I was thrilled with. I was just happy it wasn't a two-month wait, which really would have been encumbering, I think, on our profession. So, so far, so good as far as having the exam available. I did, there, for whatever reason, there's a PSI exam center in Tempe that had a month wait for some reason. But the other exam center, the primary in Phoenix and in Tucson, was down to a week wait. Other than that, I can just give a very... just add to that a very brief update regarding the exam in general. The exam board will be embarking on another RDS, role delineation study, which will really start rolling here the end of this year. And again, we'll make sure in one way, shape, or form Arizona is represented there. The exam is alive and well. I think it's in 34 states now. And the newest is our neighboring New Mexico that is analyzing their rules, as I understand it, and they will require the NHIE. That'll be a nice state to have some reciprocity with. And I think that is the update. We do just ask that, you know, the exam takers show patience, as we all need to in many ways, you know, during this, as far as communicating with PSI is a little challenging right now. So if we do get complaints on that, you know, if you can, you know, whoever they might come to, just, you know, send them off to me, just so I can be aware and I can, you know, funnel what I can or what is appropriate back directly to the exam board itself. If we do get any negative feedback on people having to wait for the exam, I'd like to be aware of it. But I think that's all I had.
We're lucky to have you, Paul, because you're an insider, and that really helps. And so we appreciate you. Rob, did you have anything to add?
Just real quickly, what Paul said is pretty much 100% accurate based on what I've been able to decipher as well. It's impossible to get a hold of PSI if you go through their customer service line, but when the centers first opened, their home inspecting wasn't considered essential, so it was impossible to schedule an exam for a couple months. But recently I've talked to 5, 6, 7 people, and they've been saying they can get it a week out. So, and then they can switch. Once you get it locked down, you can switch and do it tomorrow if you want when an opening occurs. So there's been a lot of success now. It was really hard when they first opened back up, but I think it's back on track.
Very good. That's good. Sure. Okay. Is there any other discussion on agenda item D? Hearing none, we'll consider that kind of closed. And thank you for that update. It's good to know. And do we have Melissa on the line?
No, she probably won't be here until 10 or a little after 10. She had another meeting that she was had to be at.
My screen shows that she joined. But she's muted.
Let me see here. She is muted. Melissa, star 6.
Hi, guys. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yep.
Excellent. Okay, I have to be on mute because I'm at home and dogs could bark at any moment.
Okay with that.
What have I missed?
Not very much. We adopted the minutes and just kind of entered into the meat of the agenda. We have addressed, I kind of shuffled things just waiting for you.
Oh, you're sweet. Thank you.
Yeah, so we completed items J and D, and that is all. So now I think if it's okay with you and the timing feels good to you, we can start from the top. I just wanted to get any unknown or nuances to the effects on the BTR of the COVID issue.
Well, thankfully, and I'm knocking on wood now, none of our staff have COVID, which is great. But what we've done is implemented a telework schedule where we're trying to minimize the exposure of staff. So I think all of you know that most of our staff is cross-trained. So we always have a backup for somebody, especially in licensing and operations. So what we're doing is we gave people laptops, and like the two licensing techs, one will telework one day with a laptop and the other will telework the next day with a laptop. And we're able electronically now to use the laptops to check voicemail and, of course, our emails. So staff is able to stay up on questions applicants might have on their application status and return calls even when they're not in the office. So hopefully that staff thinks that's going well, and I think it is. Rob has been really good about staying up on people's productivity. Everybody signs in online in the morning, and he gets copies of everybody's emails. So he's really able to stay up on the workload and assist when and if remote working becomes challenging, especially to the public in terms of getting answers to questions. So we've also had the office cleaned. That happened at the early part of April, just because we weren't sure who may have come in and whether anyone was infected. So we had the office professionally cleaned, and I think we've been really good at staying up to date on processing applications, renewals, and investigations. Doug's had the enforcement staff working remotely almost as soon as we heard about COVID-19, and so our investigators have laptops and work remotely. They do come into the office one day a week and check in with Doug as well on their workloads. So I think it's been going pretty well. Hopefully the pandemic will disappear, as our president says, and we resume work as usual. But for now, we are trying to minimize exposure with the public and with our staff.
Great. Well, you're a great leader, Melissa, and you have awesome leaders alongside you, and we appreciate that. Is there any identified, I guess, really, as it relates to the home inspection side, is there any identified bottlenecks that exist at all in the processing, licensing, or complaints, or any trouble spots?
Yeah, I'd like to say there are none so far. We've been doing this just over a month with licensing, working from home, and we've added a couple more EAC members who are doing evaluations. So I believe the process is about just as quick as it has been. So it's good. We've maintained our levels of productivity as far as processing application in a timely manner. So
outstanding. You guys are awesome. So far. It's not easy. This transition's not easy. You guys did a great job. Is there any other questions that folks would have for Melissa or Rob, or any other discussion items on that? Hearing none, I think we've completed that. So going to move on to agenda item B, and it is entitled Board Member Composition Changes. But actually, if we could also include Eugene, if Eugene could just introduce himself and talk a little. We haven't met, and I just wanted to kind of have everybody meet you.
Sure, Dave. Jim Montgomery. I've been a board member now for several years, and I have expertise in mechanical engineering, which involves a whole set of, let's say, allied disciplines to home inspections, such as plumbing, HVAC, minor structural. So that's kind of my background, but again, mostly in a more engineering application, and not in home inspection. So I have little to no home inspection experience other than being a customer.
Awesome. Well, that's great background, and we're glad to have you, and I think you'll find the discussions here quite interesting, so welcome.
Thank you.
So then, as it relates to the board member composition changes, if you have anything on that, Melissa?
Well, probably nothing new, but I'm not certain that all of you know that August 25th, the bill 1274 that changes the board composition becomes effective. We're still waiting to hear and receive legal advice from the AG's office on whether we can keep some of our currently sitting board members. Many of our board members, including Gene, unfortunately, have terms that have expired. Gene has not been reappointed or replaced, so we're hoping we can keep him, but we need to hear the legal advice about that. And what the board composition will look like is it will grow from 9 members to 11. 6 of those members will be public members, meaning they won't be representing the 5 professions that have historically sat on the board. And then 5 of the members will represent those 5 professions, 1 for each. So we'll have 1 engineer member, 1 architect member, 1 survey member, 1 landscape architect, and 1 geologist member. What I did hear from the AG's office, and I did email the committee about, is that there's nothing in the law that prohibits public members being part of the licensed population that we regulate. So I'm hoping that Peter indicated he would willingly put in an application as a public member, and I think it would be great if the governor's office would recognize the importance of having a home inspector on the board, given, you know, the applications and the enforcement actions that we process. But we don't know. We haven't heard anything from the governor's office about who they might appoint. They are obliged by law to send me a copy of any appointment letters that they make, and the executive director is supposed to sign off on that before it becomes lawful and send it back to the governor. But I'm sure he's been inundated with the COVID crisis, and I'm not sure if we'll know by the end of August who our public members will be, and in fact who our professional members will be, because there are only 2 of the 9 members currently serving, our landscape architect, land surveyor position, and 1 of our architect positions that are still on official terms. So everything's kind of up for grabs at this point, and hopefully we'll know soon, but I don't have really anything definitive to tell you other than everything's up in the air.
Okay, well, that makes sense, and thank you so much for the update. We'll keep that. If you could, Kurt, go ahead and throw that down as a future agenda item on the fly here. Anything else? Does anybody have any questions or anything else to address on that matter? Hearing none, then we'll move on. And again, let's keep that on the agenda for next meeting and move on to agenda item C. It's BTR rules package status. I hope all of us read through the rules package change. And I wondered, Melissa, if we could talk about also, is there, since rules packages are a difficult process, is there anything in existence for like an emergency type action, you know, inquire to the governor if he would approve an emergency action, say if the exam something went crazy or whatever got in the way of our licensing process or the any of your processes, is there something beyond the rules package if that could be addressed here as well?
Well, there is a provision in the statute that provides for the making of emergency rules, but the word emergency is kind of misleading because there still is a process we have to undertake, and I believe we would still have to ask the governor's office for permission to undertake an emergency rulemaking process. I don't remember exactly what the differences are. I think in large part it's pretty similar to a standard rulemaking process, except that we might not have to go through as much scrutiny at the Regulatory Review Council. But I can look that up if that's something you're interested in.
Yeah, I'd like to have that in our back pocket. I believe, Peter, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe in our 20 years doing this, that's occurred before. We've done an emergency rules package, haven't we?
Emergency rule, yeah.
I don't remember what it was on, but
emergency
rules, it'd be good to have.
We did emergency rules. Well, we worked on emergency rules right from the very beginning. It was an emergency rule that that created the rules and stay-at-home inspector certification program, actually.
Yeah, and I think we amended it somewhere along the line with that method, but I don't recall what it, the details or, yeah, if we could be up to speed, not so much else, but if you guys could, as an agency, be up to speed on that, just in case, so we don't run into any additional problems here. Hopefully we won't, but it's nice to know.
Okay. I'll definitely do the research and get you the info on emergency rulemaking, just so we have the process available and we understand it if we need to use it.
Perfect. And then I think this, our portion of the existing rules package relates to requiring financial assurance beyond retirement or an inactive status, and I hope everyone read through that, and it looks like there was some objections to 2 years and maybe some acceptance of 1 year. Am I reading that right, Melissa? Is that your take?
Yes.
Okay. How do you as an agency feel about that?
Well, I think we need to comply with the law, and that's paramount first and foremost. I understand that the financial assurance is a perceived hardship on folks that may be going inactive or retiring, but obviously the insurance end of it requires that the financial assurance be available should anyone need to make a claim at some point after a licensee becomes inactive or retires. So that was the underlying legal premise for it, and clearly our rule really needs to comply with what the law requires. So that's why it's been amended and is up for review.
I think there's a lot of logic in that, so that there's not some strange safe harbor that people run to get out of a claim, whether they're retiring or not. You know,
right.
So I'm in favor of the premise of the rules change. How do the members here, especially the inspector folks, or even everybody on Andrew and Gene, how do you feel about 1 year versus 2 years?
This is Andy. I don't know that I have a strong preference on that.
It's within one of the comments that Home Inspector has sent for the supplement.
Mm-hmm.
So you scroll past the actual rule part, you'll see about three or four email comments, and I believe it's the last comment in which you'll see that the individual had brought up that his financial assurance was a 1 year, he had argued.
Kurt, this is Gene Montgomery,
mm-hmm.
if I may. I'm relying on Andy for some legal advice on this. You know, my quick research take on this, although pretty shallow maybe, indicates that the Arizona revised statutes for limitation of liability on real property damage is pretty ironclad to be 2 years. There's a ARS section 12-542, which states, unequivocally, a two-year statute of limitation on real property damage from any cause, okay? Now, in order for a home inspector to revise that, I don't know, if he wants to try an exculpatory clause or if he wants to try and reel it in for 60 days or 1 year, according to my quick review, there has been case law where that's been overthrown by the court. You just can't, unilaterally decide that you're going to take a period of time less than the statute. So what is your take on that, Andy?
Well, so the two-year statute, I mean, you're right on the two-year statute, but that, I mean, just so you know, in practice, because we also have a discovery rule, the 2 years doesn't begin to run until the claimant knew or with reasonable certainty should have known about the who and the what. So the 2 years doesn't in and of itself, if there's an extension for 2 years, it doesn't in and of itself protect everyone.
Yeah, I would agree that the 2 years has nothing to do with when they retire their license. In fact, the relevance of the starting cycle should be at the last inspection. When they've completed their last inspection, that particular case would have a maximum of 2 year statute to file a damage claim. So the law is a little ambiguous on that point, or the revised statute.
Well, I guess I don't know that every insurance company offers tail coverage. I don't know how long they offer as a something to purchase, and I don't know if a bonding company could just a bond could be purchased for 1 or 2 years if the prior protection or financial assurance mechanism was E&O insurance. So there might be some questions there on that, but I'm guessing that the bond could be purchased for sure, and then they would be in compliance. That's my reasonably assured assumption there. So to be in compliance inexpensively, a bond could be purchased even if you prior to the retirement or whatever have held E&O insurance. And I think that a reasonable approach.
David, this is Peter. I want to interject here. It's always been my understanding that anybody can go after a home inspector for the work that he did at any time. There's no statute of limitations. The neighbor...
There is
a... Right? In home inspections. A home inspection... Who's speaking over me?
I'm sorry. Hey, it's Keith Smith, and I just wanted to mention 12-530 for the state home inspector liability, there's a four-year limitation.
Okay, so we have a four-year limitation. So what, in fact, is the purpose of... What in fact is the purpose of carrying the financial insurance for 2 years, David? I don't understand. Yeah, are we worried about the home inspector putting his license inactive just to avoid something, to avoid a complaint against him or a liability against him? When we do already have 4 years where anybody can complain against the home inspector.
I think that there have been a number of folks that have gone inactive or maybe in retired status or even perhaps even cancellations and let it just simply lapse without saying a word. And there's a high level of concern about where the public has any recourse if people just drop off the map or go retire and quit paying for any kind of financial insurance, then it could end the day they do that. So,
yeah, but that wouldn't alleviate their liability, which means that it would go into civil court and they'd be sued. Would they
true,
not? But am I wrong about this?
No, that's true. But the statute for provisions for financial assurance are a step beyond requiring everybody's client to go that far. So it is a required statutory provision that protects the public from the home inspector's actions. Can you speak to this at all, Melissa?
I mean, other than what we've done in terms of research, it really looks like we have to have the 2 years. It's part of the law, and obviously our rule needs to mirror and further elaborate on what we're required to do legally. So we're here to protect the public. That's the whole purpose of regulation. And I would hate to see us make the mistake of not complying with what the law requires.
Well, I think that settles it right there.
when you put it that way.
Yeah, I don't know. Is there any discussion in conflict with that, what Melissa just said?
Just to clarify, so Melissa, what you're saying is that we have to have a two-year bond beyond the last inspection that a home inspector does before he retires. However, these gentlemen, Eugene and Andrew, were talking about a three-year reciprocity in business, I'm assuming, and then not reciprocity, but rather, what's the word I'm looking
liability.
For?
Liability.
Yeah, thank
liability.
You.
Liability.
Three-year liability, yeah. Business-wise. And yet the home inspection, the home inspector is liable for his inspections for 4 years, but we're going to cut this back to two. I just don't understand the logic in any of it.
I understand, Peter. It's very frustrating because of the different laws and the different requirements that seem to be in place.
So I think we have to match the law, and period, unless we go to the legislature and change statute.
Yeah, I think Marissa's right. We have to match the law, David, and I think we should do the minimum, to be honest with you, because we're going to... if a home inspector wants to go out of business, if he wants to retire or he wants to go inactive, I feel he's going to be liable in the courts regardless of what he does as far as the financial assurance goes. So it's my opinion that if Melissa feels that we have to match that law, then I think minimally and we should match the law and be done with it. Because the home inspector, if he messed up 4 years later, he's going to get hurt for it. And it doesn't matter. I mean, I know we have to protect the general public, but we also have to concern ourselves with the home inspector, who's part of the general public. So
right.
I would go with just the 2 years and let it be. That's my opinion.
I would agree. Do you have anything on that, Paul?
You know, I think the 2 years is a bit onerous. You know, it sounds like we don't really have a choice, but, you know, we saw some of the emails coming in. Tail coverage on E&O is pricey, and I don't know what the options are, as you alluded to, David, of jumping into a bond when you have not had one before. I just think the 2 years is very, very pricey. Tail coverage, from what I've seen, is more than your normal annual premium. It could be 1.5 times your normal annual premium. So I can understand some of the concerns shared via the emails. I guess my question is, are we 100% sure that the two-year statute applies to our financial assurance for our profession?
Melissa?
Well, I'm not 100% sure because obviously, you know, circumstances may require different interpretations, like if someone gets sued and a court decides something different. But I'm more confident than not that it applies.
Okay. And Paul,
we may want to hear from Doug on this, Doug Parlin, if he's on the call, because honestly, he and Patty did most of the research into this for us, so I don't want to step on any toes in case, you know, more information is available that I don't have at my fingertips.
Yeah, this is Doug. You know, Patty was the one that was pretty much running with this. It's my understanding, through my discussions with her, is her research with the insurance industry related to this, is where she came up with the 2 years. That the insurance company would be, the coverage would be intact for 2 years as long as it's maintained beyond the, you know, the period where the licensee went inactive. But insurance, once the insurance is canceled and no longer in effect, then the 2 years goes away. So, I mean, that's all I really have to add to this.
Well, and Paul, just to be clear for everyone, you weren't implying that it costs 1.5 times for each year, right? We're not implying that.
No, but I did understand that if you're paying $3,000 a year for an E&O premium, tail coverage could be $4,500.
For how long?
You know, per year for.
It's not more than just paying for another year of insurance. I'll guarantee you that.
Okay. Yeah, I had heard that. You know, it was more, but maybe that's carrier dependent. I don't know.
Well, then you would just buy another year of coverage at the one times rate, right? You know,
and not do any inspections, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll guarantee you that's not the case. But I know. I think it's important that we kind of let the rules process, the rule change process, kind of proceed and comply with what the statute's saying. And then if anything else comes up, Melissa, even if we have to meet, you know, on an emergency basis to deal with any twists and turns that it takes, let us know.
If
that makes sense to everyone.
Right. We're still going to have to make an appearance at the Governor's Regulatory Review Council and answer questions, possibly, hear comments and see if this is something that passes. So,
no date set for that, though, yet?
No, not yet.
Okay.
This is Kurt Winter. I would like to inform the committee as well that we do have an oral proceeding that will happen on September 10th. The Secretary of State has not yet posted the notice. The notice I heard from Rhonda at SOS is that it will be posted on the 7th, the 7th. It may be, I think it's the 7th. And once that is posted and she lets me know of it, I will put it on our website. It'll be up for 30 days so that the public will know about it. I will probably send out a mass email to all registrants to let them know about the oral proceeding, and then that will occur on the 10th of September, and anybody who wishes to speak on the subject will be able to appear and do that.
Okay. Are we looking for a member of our committee to be there, Melissa, would you say?
Yes, that would be super helpful. So if someone wants to call in or be part of that on September 10, we would really appreciate it.
Did you say you could call in? They're having these types of meetings?
Right. I mean, just like we're meeting today virtually, we're going to have a Google meeting as well because of the pandemic. So we want to be able to make access available to the public who don't want to come down in person but want to participate and ask questions and hear the discussion. So if anyone can appear either in person or telephonically on the 10th for that oral meeting, staff would really appreciate it.
Would you be sure and send out a specific email to the three home inspector members of this committee with the login URL and all that?
You'll get an email from Kurt. He's very diligent and capable about all this Google stuff.
yeah, he's good. Okay, awesome. Thanks. Then we'll probably keep, just for your knowledge, Kurt, we'll keep C on the future agenda there, I'm guessing. Let's see. We went through item D. The next one is agenda item E, home inspection education providers. So, I'm not
David,
sure.
This is Peter. Yeah, can we back up 1 second, please?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry. I didn't ask for any final words.
I'm still stuck on this obligation. My concerns are this: if we actually carry a bond beyond our active date, say for 2 years, as we're talking, will the insurance company consider that a tail? And if they don't, would they require a tail on top of that bond for another year? I mean, these are questions that actually really need to be answered. If we required a home inspector to carry his bond or his E&O insurance for 2 years after he's gone inactive, and then the insurance company doesn't consider that the end game for him, but makes him do it for another year, such as written in this gentleman's Bernie Rubin, who's got an early certification. I'm very happy with this guy's response. But he did say that, according to the language of his bond, it says, this bond shall be one continuing obligation in the liability of the surety for the aggregate of any and all claims which has been awarded by litigation. Deemed uncollectible shall in no event exceed the amount of the penalty thereof. However, no suit may be commenced on the bond after the expiration of 1 year following the rendering of the services on which the suit is based. And then this Bernie Rubin goes on to say that it's his understanding that the E&O insurance can pay a reduced amount to the insurance company for a tail coverage for them for 1 year following the termination of the insurance. The cost of the tail coverage, although less than the actual premium, could be substantial. I'm just not sure how these insurance companies, these E&O insurance companies and bond companies, are going to look at our 2 years and whether they're going to consider it a tail or whether they're going to add a tail to that. Can we find out?
I can speak to that. I'm in my renewal period right now for E&O insurance, and I don't have a lot of knowledge on bonds, but on the E&O insurance side, I found out yesterday that the carrier I have actually has accepted ASHI members as being able to receive 5 years of free tail coverage. Once you do have to like totally retire or whatever, but I found that out yesterday, oddly. And then I asked him, so wow, what kind? That's amazing. What kind of value is that? And he said, well, we only write up to 3 years of coverage, and it's slightly reduced from what it would normally cost in the first year, and then it drops from there as well. So he didn't give me any exact numbers on, you know, a percentage of reduction, but it's available. It's common in the insurance side. Bonding companies can write their own rules, it looks like. So, and I know you have experience with bonds, Peter. Is there a chance you can research that a little bit?
Like, yeah, I'll look into that as well. But now I have a question for you. That opens up another door for me. On the E&O insurance, say, for instance, they are giving you 5 years of free tail coverage. Would that be considered, would that be acceptable for this rule that we're trying to write for the 2 years of extended coverage?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about.
Okay, yeah. So if you can prove 3 to 5 years of tail coverage, and if it comes to you free through ASHI, which is wonderful, that you think that that would cover the rule? That you think that would satisfy the rule?
Well, absolutely. You know, I was kind of surprised by it, so I was like, show me the document that says that. And he emailed it to me. It's quite simple and simply says, if you're an ASHI member, and again, you must completely retire, you can't dabble or anything, but then it's free. So, you know, the insurance companies might all be doing different things, but this language that Bernie was sent at home inspection included, you know, we don't know if that's the exact language of his bond, and the exact interpretation of that would need a little bit of legal review. But, I think insurance, it's super common that, you know, people will have available to them tail coverage, and if they happen to own like an occurrence-based policy, they would have coverage beyond the conclusion of their career as well. But that's a lot more rare type of insurance. Occurrence-based insurance is way more rare than a claims-made type.
Yeah, and this Bernie Rubin with Hill and Usher, who he's quoting, that they're a bond company, they're a surety company, not an E&O company. I don't believe that they offer E&O. I believe they offer bonds, but I'll look into that too. And
okay, see. If you look into that and then communicate with Melissa or or whoever's lead on this, and then address this from the bond side, and if there's anything that us as a committee need to rethink, you know, maybe just bring it back to us.
I will. And Melissa, I just want to ask you what I just asked David. Do you feel that this tail coverage, regardless of where it comes from, as long as it's there, would satisfy the rule that we're trying to make here?
I think so.
Okay, then. I'm happy. Thank you. Thank you,
David. Hey, guys, this is Robert.
Yeah, Robert.
I just want to chime in real quick just to let you guys know what the effects of this are. I don't believe it's going to affect too much other than people won't be able to place their license on inactive unless they provide us proof of financial assurance. So if you want to take a break and go inactive, you'll have to prove financial assurance. However, if you're delinquent for one day, correct me if I'm wrong, Melissa or Doug, if somebody goes delinquent, I don't think there's any repercussions of them not having financial assurance because we cannot suspend or revoke a delinquent license. And if somebody is canceled after 1 year of being delinquent, I don't see how we can have them provide us with financial assurance. So I think the only effect would be on an inactive license, having to prove financial assurance.
I have to just add that if somebody goes delinquent, we still have jurisdiction over them, and if a complaint came in, we would still be able to investigate and take disciplinary action. So I think it does have an impact on people who are delinquent.
Okay. I would agree with that.
Okay.
But what would, this is Kurt Winter, what would stop a home inspector from just allowing their license to be canceled and not pay for the bond or the insurance?
Good question. Unless there was a complaint against him and something active.
Unless no complaint comes in.
How are you going to be able to hold his feet to the fire for that?
Well,
they would still be subject to civil penalties and board discipline, which could include restitution and admin penalties, you know, all the normal disciplinary process.
What happens if they aren't under any disciplinary, no complaint is ever issued, they just, you know, nothing happens, they're just kind of
gone? What if he's under the table? I mean, the board works on complaints.
Right.
Everything is open through a complaint. Someone would have to complain against him for doing that in order for us to even know.
Yeah.
Would we have a letter go out to folks that, you know, though you have entered into this status, you are still required to carry either existing coverage of financial assurance or tail coverage or something like that?
Yep. I think it's a good idea to notify our registrants about something like this. Very important, and they should be aware of it. So, I think we can certainly, and we will, be sending notice out about this.
Okay.
It's actually recently been added to the
inactivation form.
Inactivation form. So it's notice is provided on the form itself.
That you need to maintain.
You would execute the go inactive.
Okay. Very good.
Very good. Okay.
Go ahead. Any other discussion on this?
No, thank you, David, for backing up a little bit.
Yeah, sorry I moved on too quickly there. Okay, moving on to agenda item E, it's home inspection education providers. Did you have something on that, Rob, did you say?
No, I didn't know who put that on there, but I can add to it if there's discussion.
I may have thrown that on there. I just was checking in and wanted to discuss that, you know, are the education providers having any struggles with COVID, or is everything just golden? Home inspectors can still get their classroom training. And I kind of tried to do my own research, and InterNACHI had asked me a while back too about just getting their program approved. And so, you know, online is probably what a lot of these providers are trying to switch to. And
David, I believe we got Keith Smith on the line still.
Yeah,
Keith, why don't you comment on what you guys are doing?
Okay, yeah, I contacted the state, the post-secondary department, to make sure we could hold classes. I moved into a facility last year. We've got plenty of room, so we've got more than 6 feet separation. Everybody wears a mask. We have sanitizers there, so we're doing everything that is reasonably expected. And, yeah, that's about it. And then parallels, I think you guys are going to talk about that a little later, but the parallels, we've reduced them just so we don't have too many people there.
Reduce the amount of participants, you mean?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
That makes sense. Okay, and I know there's some options on there, on the list that's provided of some online courses, and one's a new one, like, was it ATI or something like that?
ATI is a new one.
Yeah. Okay, and that's I know the owner of that or whatever, and they've been around a long time. I'm sure that's a very good course. Let's see, and then InterNACHI will probably be coming on, getting their program to where it's at an acceptable state soon. So I've been talking to them about just trying to tell them that they have to have our professional practice segment or module that addresses Arizona rules and standards specifically. So I believe they're working on that. So that should be coming. Well, if anybody, you know, on staff or any of us as home inspectors, we hear of, I just want to avoid things that become roadblocks to people entering the profession, because that's, we don't want to be an impediment to them. We want to do all we can to foresee what could happen. And Keith, you as well, if you see any spot, anything, be sure and let one of us know, and we'll just stay vigilant on that.
David, go ahead. I just want to chime in real quick, too. Just based on, we input the data now for all the schools that people go through, and I want to say that AHIT, which is online, is about, let's just say, around 60%, or maybe like 50% of the certificates we get, and it pretty much has been since I started a few years ago. So the online is still coming in pretty strong, and I think the School of Real Estate and Business in Scottsdale is no longer hosting in person, but Keith Smith School is still doing them in person classes. But we haven't had anyone call with any issues about attending the school or going to a school online. So,
okay, that's great to know. So we've got both options even. So we're seem to be in good shape, and as long as the state keeps heading in the right direction, we'll not have any trouble. Well, thank you so much. I believe I did add this on the agenda just to get it talked through. Anybody else have anything on it? Hearing nothing, concludes agenda item E. Agenda item F, firm renewal process. And I was reading through the packet, and there was something in there I did not know existed, and that was, and I don't know if we're going to talk about that, but it was the fact that it looks like for a firm, they must be a registrant, and I didn't know that was the case. So that affects every discipline, I'm assuming. So there's no like ownership companies where they don't have or the principal does not have a license. Is that the case?
Yes.
Okay, interesting. I didn't know that. And was this on here for some reason on the agenda? I don't think I put this on.
I believe Paul requested that one.
I did, yeah. And so if I can just talk to this for a moment. It sounds like, and this is maybe for Rob, it sounds like this is the first time we've done this electronically, maybe.
Right.
And I just wanted to provide a little feedback. I thought it was, you know, a little bit clunky, just in the process of it. You know, once you find it online and go to that link, you know, there's these basic questions that you have to acknowledge, you know, that if you renew too early, you could be rejected, and you have to agree to this and agree to that so you can get into the part of getting over to go ahead and pay your fee and sign the form. And you have to know to look under licensing for your firm renewal, which I thought of more of a registration than a license. But you had to know to go under licensing, and then I still want to having to follow on to print the piece of paper and scan that and send it in. I felt there was a bit of a disconnect there. And on that final form, I had to put my firm registration number in. I have no idea what that is. And so it was so much easier just to fill out the paper one, put a check in the mail and send it in. At a minimum, I guess what I'm asking is if we're going to stay with this process, if we can maybe just have a few more directions up front. Okay, these are the five steps needed to complete your firm registration. And I realize for payment now we're going over to the state, you know, payment center, software, and I understand that it kind of leaves the BTR site. But I just was wondering if we can do something to make it a little bit more straightforward for our renewals.
I think that's really good feedback, Paul. Obviously, this is a new process for us, and the intent is to make it easier for licensees to renew online, but obviously there are challenges to that. So I think, Rob, do you think, and Kurt, can we talk to DOA about ASSET, about making it more user-friendly or adding more instructions?
We've hit some roadblocks with them. They have a standard page. They have some standardized items where you have to pay and then fill out a form. But just, Paul, just so you know, ever since we did this online, I just looked it up. I've done 405 refunds of people paying too soon or paying twice in a row, or maybe you send in a check, but your business partner pays online at the same time. And it's we ask these questions to make sure they look up their license and they're really ready to renew. It's amazing how many people pay twice or pay too soon or pay for the wrong license. So we've been tweaking it since we started and trying to limit the amount of bad renewals, I guess, that come through. But there is some limitations once you hit that pay page. It's now on ASSET who runs the page. So Kurt's been doing a really good job updating and tweaking it, but we're always up for feedback and trying to refine it. But that's where I'm at.
This is Kurt Winter. Paul, I've also, those prompt questions are there, and it's just, as Rob has said, just to let people, you know, are you sure that you know you're ready to do this? And we still get a lot of people who aren't and don't follow the directions. They just hit acknowledge, keep going, zoom, 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 and maybe make the payment, don't fill out the form, and so forth. And so that's a lot of extra work on our end if they don't do it correctly. I did change it so that when somebody goes to the firm and they acknowledge all the pages, that it takes them directly to the licensing page instead of the home page, so that they see the firm is there. I had asked ASSET to create a new tab just for firms within the payment portal, but they said they were busy with other things at the time, so it wasn't a priority. But I will try to get back with them, so because that's been brought up before by others as well. It's kind of hard to find the firm information, so I am going to still press ASSET to change that up so it's just out there in their face. This is where the firms are.
Yeah, and thank you guys so much for the feedback and I don't know if it makes sense to, you know, whenever we get onto the AZBTR site for the firm registration process, you know, if it's not clear or prominent, we could say, okay, these are the four or five steps and you must complete all of them in order to renew your firm registration, just so it's clear, because after I thought I was done, then I got an email back saying, oh, by the way, you have to fill out this form and scan it back to us, you know. So,
but there shouldn't be any scanning whatsoever. That confused me when you said that, because if you go to that form, it does Adobe sign that it emails it to us. There shouldn't be any printing and scanning involved.
Okay. Maybe it was Adobe, but at any rate, when I thought I was done, then I got another email back saying you're not really done.
Yeah, we've tried. Asset won't really change all the language on their page. The payment site, you make the payment, and then there's just this little bit that says, okay, now you have to proceed to the forum and sign it. And they can't really make it as prominent as we ask them to make it prominent. That's why we have so many instructions on our site. But there's so many instructions on our site, I think people just skim right through it. That's why we had to create the acknowledgement questions, and people are still not doing it right, even through those acknowledgement questions. So it's hard to try to get people to do it right.
If you give them too much information, they don't read it. You don't give them enough, and there's no direction. We haven't found the in-between, and we've done about 20 tweaks since we put it online. So, okay. But we do appreciate the feedback.
Yeah, thank you guys for letting me vent a little bit. And I know it's a balance there of not enough and too much information, and hopefully we'll find it. But we're still going to continue at this point to send out the annual paper renewals in the postal mail, correct?
Correct. And don't forget, Paul, we still have staff here, so if you have questions, just call, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
That's awesome. Well, sounds like
David.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Keith. I have a question.
Go ahead.
Okay, I was looking at the document that's provided in this meeting here, and it talks about the Arizona Board of Technical Registration policy and procedures, and it says licensing unit policy, but it doesn't state home inspector, but we've always done the firm registration, so it should have home inspectors on there, correct?
You're right, Keith. I think we need to update the policy. It's back from 2018, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so I think it should also include home inspectors, because clearly you guys have the same requirement as the other professions we regulate.
Okay, and then, excuse me, one other thing. As a educational provider, we've been telling our students that if you have an LLC, if you have an LLC, even if you're working for somebody else, you need to do a firm registration. Is that correct?
I don't understand the question, really. You have an LLC for home inspections, but you're working for some other home inspection company. Is that what you're saying, Keith?
Correct.
Why would you register a firm for home inspections if you're working for a different home inspection company?
Yeah. Okay, that's what I need clarification on, because many years ago, the guy left the office. He was in charge of violations or whatever, but he said every single inspector had to have a firm registration. So I'd like clarification just so I can pass it on.
Yeah, no, I don't believe that's true. Every single inspector has to have a certification number, but I believe just the firm has to have a firm number.
Whoever the firm is providing the professional services, that firm needs to be registered.
Right, that's right. So you could be a multi-inspector firm. You could be, if you're a single operator, you have to have a firm. You have to have something. If you're working by yourself, however, if you're working for someone else, you don't need one for yourself.
Even if you have a corporation set up, because that seems to be the hanging point. If you look at your policy LI-34, it states the ARS 3201027. These guys are their own officer of their corporation, even though they're working for somebody else.
What's their corporation doing? Home inspections?
Okay. Yeah.
I don't see why they would need to if they're working for someone else, unless they're working for both. If they're working for both, I would say yes. You know, if they're part-time working for somebody and part-time working for themselves. But if they
if they work for somebody else, it's got it. That company has to have it.
That's right. That would be the firm registration. And then, but then if they're doing them on the side for themselves, they're going to need another firm registration for themselves.
Gotcha.
Okay, good.
Okay, very good. Anything else on agenda item F? Hearing nothing, we'll move on to item G is home inspectors reapplying after certification cancellation.
All right. I put this one on there, David, if you'd like me to speak on that.
Please.
Well, I did send an email to Kurt that was put into the packet. But basically, we've had some inspectors, and because you only have a one-year renewal period, when you become delinquent, you get canceled after 1 year and 1 month. So what happens is someone like, I'm going to use Peter Leeds. Peter Leeds has been licensed since we started. If he became canceled just from not paying for 1 year or intentionally, he would have to reapply as if he's a new applicant. He would have to go back to school. He would have to take the national exam. He'd have to do 30 parallels, even though he's already done 10,000 paid inspections. And we've run into this a few times. And I know it's on them. They need to renew their license. I just wanted to bring it to your attention that this seems pretty extreme for somebody who's been practicing for 15 years to have to go through all those hoops all over again.
I would agree with that. I know that when we wrote the statute and the rules, we did not have information about different classifications of, you know, delinquent and canceled and inactive and all of that. So we did not have the ability to regard it. It was not part of the process. I think we need to discuss what would be fair and then what it takes to change it. Starting with the second one I mentioned, is it something that can be done within the agency that doesn't require a rules change to address these different classifications different from one another?
Peter, right. And Dave, this is Melissa. We, if you remember, when the agency was up for sunset, we discussed the one-year certification in our statutes, and we discussed that 1 year seemed kind of short, but the committee at that time thought that that's what the industry really wanted, was a one-year certification rather than a three-year like what we had with the other professions we regulate, or even a two-year, which at the time was what we had with the alarms, that the mobility of your profession really accommodated a one-year requirement. And we would have to change the statute to change that. So that means finding a lobbyist or, you know, lobbying the legislature, finding someone to sponsor a bill.
Yeah, I know that process.
And can't
pick that. But so you're saying it cannot be corrected in rule or altered. Is that correct?
No, because it's in statute currently, so that would have to be changed. And I recognize that it's a hardship, but what we've tried to do is notify our registrants as much as we possibly can, you know, sending out renewal forms by paper, making sure they understand that they can renew online, and emailing people and putting things in the newsletter. So I understand it's a hardship for those that are canceled, but that goes along with the privilege of being a licensee.
Yeah.
Rob, well, this is
Peter.
Peter.
This is Peter. Rob,
okay.
You say that it goes a whole year and then a month before it's canceled?
Right.
All right, so the home inspector is a year, is 13 months beyond when it was due?
Correct.
Okay. That's a pretty long period of time, actually. But the I think that he ought to be able to wake up sometime in that 13 months. On the other hand, are these problems happening from people who accidentally get canceled or accidentally forget to, or were they really considering quitting and then change their minds?
It could be a little of both, but we've seen a few accidental ones. And here's the problem is the board, we send quite a bit of notice out, but if we don't have your correct information, and we've switched software three times in the past 3 years, that it's unfortunate. I've sent mail out, and it's your old Kingman address, so you didn't get that renewal. You didn't get the email because I have an old email on file, or the email didn't transfer over the third time. So some of it is accidental. Some of it is, I think I'm going to take a break. Oh, wait, when I come back, I have to do this. So it's ignorance to the rule on their part. But they only have a year, whereas our professions have 3 years of delinquency before they get canceled. So it's just something we've come across, and it's a pretty big hardship when you think that you're – so a lot of them think they're still licensed and find out they're canceled and have to stop practicing, go back to school, get a certificate. And they've had to go through it, but it's about a 2-3 month process to get the parallels, the school, the national exam, and then become a home inspector again. So I just want to bring it up for your attention. I also do want to put out one more thing, and that is that because of this, we are reaching out to cancel. Before you get canceled, Peter, I call every month and I send an email. If I can't get a hold of you by phone, I tell you you're going to be canceled. Are you okay with this? So we are reaching out. So we are doing stuff that does not involve rulemaking. It just involves more interaction on the part of the staff. And we are sending multiple delinquent notices now instead of your so if you're delinquent as a home inspector, you'll get it right away, maybe like 2 weeks after you become delinquent. Then you'll get another email 6 months afterwards so that you know. So we're trying to add some safeguards there. But I just want to bring it to your attention. We have had quite a few grandfathered in people that have to go through that process.
I think you're doing a great job, but we do have to remember that the onus is always on the registrant to do his job, to do his due diligence. But Melissa, I have a question for you. If in fact it was a staff or a computer mess up, would the board be able to waive the requirement if it could be proven that it was an email that got transferred improperly or something like that, and nothing to do with the home inspector himself?
I would have to look at the circumstances of a case like that, yeah. But I'm certainly of the opinion that the board has legal authority to correct its mistakes.
Okay, so if the mistake was the home inspector's, he's going to have to eat that. But if the mistake came from someplace else, he does have recourse with the board, right?
Right.
Okay,
right.
I'm not concerned with it, Rob. I'm really not. How many of these have you had?
Maybe eight in the last, let's just say in 365 days, so eight in a year.
Eight in a year?
Eight? Yeah. Seriously?
We need to actually, okay, well, maybe we ought to put it in the newsletter for these guys to pay attention to their registrations.
Right.
We all have reoccurring events every year. I can tell you, as the lobbyist for the home inspection profession, that process takes so much money that is not currently available and so much time and effort. I don't see it as a high priority that'll likely move forward. I would just say everybody here on the call and everybody listening in should be attending to your own requirements of your profession. So
yeah, the onus is on the home inspector. I agree with you, David.
Right. Yep.
This is Kurt Winter, and I have a quick question because in my mind, of course, it's us sending out communications, as Rob has said, is kind of a nicety on our part. It's part of more of our policy and processes within the office, not rules, not laws, and the law says that they need to renew on time, the onus is on them. And I just heard that they can talk to the board about it and say that it wasn't their fault. And I'm curious how that would go about, because I personally don't see how they can get around the law or what the board could do to help them.
Well, Well, this is Melissa. I'm hypothesizing here, but you know, we would obviously have to have a written request with some explanation about, you know, I sent in a check, I sent you my renewal, it didn't happen. We would have to research that to determine if there was some kind of computer error or human error. And if so, we would bring it to the board and ask the board to go ahead and determine whether the mistake was on the part of the agency or not. And then I think there would be an order that would say, you know, whether, yes, it was error on the part of the board or and reinstate the license. But I haven't heard that that's been the problem with the eight people that apparently were canceled and had to start over.
Would you say failure on our part to get a letter to them or email to remind them is the board's fault in this scenario?
This is Peter once again. No, that's not what I'm talking about. When I'm talking about recourse with the board, I'm talking about, for instance, that the computer crashed in the middle of an email and brought it up with the wrong letter in it or something like that. If you're sending a renewal to Kingman and the guy moved to Scottsdale, it's his responsibility to tell you that move. It's his responsibility as a home inspector, as a registrant, to tell you his new address, his new email if he has it, all of those things. The one time I was talking about recourse with the board would be a complete breakdown of an electronic system. Not because we didn't send them courtesy emails or we didn't send them courtesy notices. That's not what I'm talking about.
Okay, thank you for the clarification. I didn't quite catch that part of it.
Agree.
Okay.
Yeah, and this is Paul. Just to add in real quick, you know, we did have one of our guys go through this about 3-4 years ago. It appears that at the time, I don't think the BTR's communication was as robust as it might be now, but it was simply never got an email, never got a phone call, of course. And the BTR did have his correct email address, but found out at the, you know, while he was on an inspection that he was not a registrant anymore. And so he had to go through and obviously do the NHIE and all the requirements again. And, you know, it was not in his junk mail. It just, he never got it. He never got the email. I think it might have been only one, maybe two of them that got sent out. And I felt bad for him. He had to go 2.5 months with no income. I just felt that the state of Arizona could have communicated with him better at the time. And I just felt bad for him. And especially having to go through each of the steps. And, you know, if the best we can do is better communication, then that's the best we can do. But if we're able to waive certain requirements, whether it's NHIE or 30 parallels or the 84 hours, you know, it'd be great if we had that latitude. It sounds like we don't. But it was just it was a real hardship. And it was a mistake in that. You know, we're all responsible professionals. We get a bill, we pay it. We get an email, we respond to it. But if it's out of sight, out of mind, and you're busy doing inspections, you can see where this could easily happen to eight people over the last year. So I do think this is an, you know, important concern for us.
Dave, this is Keith. I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is for Rob. I understand last year the governor had an order, executive order, to allow out-of-state inspectors to come in with reduced licensing requirements. Is that correct?
It wasn't the executive order. It was like a universal licensure statute or rule.
Remember what their requirement is? It's reduced. I know that.
It's just to prove they've been practicing for a year in a different state, and then they have to prove they have not had any disciplinary action, and they also have to be a resident. So,
is there any
resident,
way to tie,
if I can interject,
was there any way to tie that in?
I'm I'm sorry. Let me interject in that. They also, their background, their certification in the other state has to be equivalent to Arizona's certification. As far as the testing, as far as everything goes. Now, they may not have to have 30 parallels, but I believe we leave it up to the board to decide whether this person, or even up to the executive director, actually, to decide whether what this guy's application says is equivalent to what we require of our resident home inspectors to do. Is that not right, Melissa?
That's correct, Peter. So it's a little more involved than just they get to come in with reduced requirements. That's not true.
Yeah, I don't believe the requirements are reduced. Maybe the parallel inspections are different, but this person's supposed to be in business doing actual home inspections in another state, which I think that the board, if they had to review it, would consider those equivalent to our parallel inspections if he's done 30 of them. Keith, it's not really reduced at all. It is hard to govern. We're trusting staff and the board to actually review these cases, and if they have questions, they actually have the ability to bring them to the Rules and Standards Committee for an opinion. But it's not like it's a back door or an easy way yet.
This is David Swartz. Hang on. This is David Swartz, sure. Chairman, and I'm going to rein this in. We're drifting off topic here, and I think we've addressed the cancellation of certifications based on delinquencies, and I think we need to move on. I know that we're not supposed to be off topic this far, so.
Thanks, Dave.
You're welcome. Okay, so I think that would conclude item G. And we would encourage, and we thank you for all that effort you go through to notify people when they're delinquent. So let's...
all I can do for now, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and I think all home inspectors need to be taught to get it in your calendar on a reoccurring basis, you know, that every April you've got to renew your license. You know, it's just not that hard in this day and age.
Yeah.
That's just an opinion there. Let's move on to item number 8, and that is discussion and possible action on whether to amend AAC R430-102 definitions of parallel inspection and parallel inspector. So I put this one on here just to bring it up as a not something we can do something about right now that would take a rule change, but I just want to give consideration to what COVID represents now and what we had originally designed in the old days when writing the original rules. And then just as somebody who's been trying to accommodate folks and provide parallel inspections for the whole time, we've been doing that. And just an observation in retrospect, I want to give that too. So just to carry on that discussion. We have in rule that the parallel inspection may not have more than 4 students, basically, if you'll allow me to call them that, along with 1 supervising inspector. And we had always envisioned that to be somebody who's performing an actual inspection. And so that's the cause of the limitation. And having been trying to provide these for folks for 20 years or 17 actually, we see it as it's virtually impossible to do an effective job of providing parallel inspections if you have more than 2 actually. However, if there were somebody that were separate performing the supervisory duty, you know, there may be a place for that to be even more than 4. So I don't know. I just want to kick off discussion and maybe talk going forward and possible future action on whether we have interest in revising that. You know, if you had 2 inspectors there, one is not doing the home inspection for a client. They're simply supervising the inspectors, the student inspectors only, then potentially that could be at a higher number of students as a requirement. And then, I don't know, I'd be in favor of lowering it if you're trying to also do an inspection at the same time, but, you know, that's another topic of discussion. So I wanted to throw that out there. Have any thoughts on that, Peter or Paul?
Well, Peter does. The what we're doing is home inspector with no more than three other trainees, right?
Four.
Yeah, well, four altogether with the home inspector and three trainees, right?
Isn't it four?
Hang on a minute. It says here the home parallel inspection means a home inspection completed by a blah, 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 inspector acting as a parallel inspector in the presence of no more than three other applicants, right in the rule.
Oh.
Okay? So you got one certified home inspector, you got three applicants. Now, I don't know what COVID's going to do to this, but if you had two certified home inspectors, it looks to me like you could have six applicants. Okay? And if you had three certified home inspectors, I believe you could have nine applicants, all on the same job, all under different tutelage, all doing the same project. Okay? I don't see why we have to change that at all, baby.
So the multiple of three is reasonable if there's one supervising inspector attending to them exclusively?
Right. Yeah, that's what we did. And I remember when I was teaching over there at Phoenix College, we used to take the whole class out on parallel inspections. We had two houses. We probably had, and we had, you know, the right amount of certified inspectors with 2 to 3 applicants or students with them at the same time, all on two or three houses. But mostly just on two houses side by side, because the teachers that teach at Phoenix College were donating their houses for inspections. And as long as they were following the rules, sticking with their one one mentor, and didn't get involved with the others, the system worked out pretty good. So I don't see, you can, if you have four certified home inspectors all in the same house, it seems to me you could have 12 trainees. Now, the guys that run these parallel inspections in the schools, they understand this. Right, Keith? You understood it that way, did you not? Did we lose?
Well, I'm here, but I agree with Dave. I think you're allowed actually four students the way it's written.
Well, the way it's written, here, I'm going to read it to you right out. It says...
Well, read it slow.
Okay, I'll read it slow. Yeah. It does say that it says... it says parallel inspection means a home inspection completed by an applicant during the application process that is supervised by a certified home inspector acting as the parallel inspector in the presence of no more than three other applicants. The applicant shall produce a report.
The one that's being referred to.
You guys are crazy. We're talking about a parallel inspection means a home inspection completed by an applicant during the... Okay. Maybe I'm the crazy one. All right, yes, yeah. I can see where you can bring that up to four. Thank you.
Yeah, it's easy to miss.
Yeah, this legalese just drives a poor man nuts.
But it's four applicants.
Yeah, you got one parallel inspector, four applicants altogether.
Right. So let me just give you background on why I bring this up. So I think it was a year ago, but at my age, the years are somewhat fuzzy, I'm going to admit. And I think it was a year ago, we felt like we were getting complaints that people cannot get their parallel inspections. So I bring this up because the solution, I ran out to Arizona ASHI and got them to create a list and try and cover as many counties in the state as we could and get a list of people who are willing to provide parallels so that that list can exist and the agency does not have that complaint coming in from people applying to be a home inspector. So just considering COVID, I just don't know the fallout, and I just bring this up because this would be one of those that could require, you know, that emergency rule change to where if people can't get their parallels again, we could look at raising the number of applicants with a supervising inspector, and I would be in favor of it potentially if they're not also having to do the home inspection at the house. If they're simply attending to the students, then, you know, I think this would be the next solution we could provide. And I just want to throw that out there as I'm kind of a visionary type thinker where I think of what's the worst case of COVID or whatever. So that's the only reason on the agenda.
Well, hey, Dave, has Rob said, Rob, are you getting any complaints?
For the parallels?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, good.
It doesn't sound like a problem.
Exactly.
I don't see it as a problem. And I don't know how you would relate that to COVID. Add more inspectors on the job because of COVID. It seems to be backwards to me. But on the other hand, you will have trouble because the parallel inspector would do this voluntarily to add more inspectors. I mean, it would be up to him. But in order to do a true parallel, now he'd be looking at more reports to review, more reports to correct, and more reports to have resubmitted. So, to do the right parallel inspector job. So I don't see that we need any changes at all, David. I really don't.
No, I'm not saying we do right now for sure. I'm just telling you a rules change can take an extremely long time. The governor doesn't favor roadblocks to licensing, and COVID, if I'm not mistaken, has resulted in a lot of home inspectors going inactive or other statuses other than active, where they are out of the game as it relates to being a supervising inspector. So COVID could have an impact, and that's what I'm just trying to pre-think. So this is not an action item, but a something I want to know about. If you can stay in touch with me, because I was the one that had to jump through hoops to get Arizona ASHI to chase down all these humans to provide parallels. So,
and David, you are right. I mean, this discussion should happen because of COVID, actually, because they're limited. I have had people call and say that it's harder to get on a parallel, but it's not significantly harder, and that's because occupied properties, a lot of times they'll say we don't want any parallels. I think Keith Smith's instructors have that issue from time to time. So, but I don't know that we can increase them somehow.
Yeah, that's a very good point because, you know, at least, you know, you could look to doing them on homes where they're not going to be occupied. Nobody will be there, and you could, you know, maximize the number of people there. But during this time, folks don't want extra students
right
in the house. So, you know, let's not behave like COVID is not having an impact here. So that's why I kind of brought this up. So in my mind, an emergency measure could be altering the maximum number. And then there's probably a couple other ideas from there. But I just bring it up because the rules changing process is so difficult that if things worsen, we're way behind the eight ball.
Right.
I guess if folks would let me know that things are occurring, I can jump on ideas for change and how to address it.
Cool. I'll let you know. I'll keep in touch with you, Dave.
Okay. Appreciate that.
On that as well, from what I hear.
Appreciate that. Any other discussion on that?